Hello, hello, hello.
Hold on 1 second. We're trying to figure out why we're not getting any vocals here.
Hello, 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 hello. Can you hear us?
That's stupid punk rock. I just think of it as rock and roll, because that's what it is.
Neighbors.
No one loves you like he loves you.
Want Bill Sperm with that?
Sunday, back in the lab.
Your answer is non-sequitur.
Hey, Punk Rock Chronicles. We're back tonight with the usual host, Stan, the man with the plan. How you doing, Stan?
Doing well, man.
And
glad
Chris,
to be here.
Chris, super producer. What's up, man?
I'm here.
And, of course, myself, Bob the Bastard. Man, this is going to be another – I say it every time. Like, oh, this is going to be epic. But they're just all epic episodes. We always have the best guests, and tonight's no exception. So, Stan, tell us before we get into the podcast and the guests we have tonight, tell us what's going on lately with us and what we're doing and, what's happening out there.
Yes. So what is happening, we're still plugging away at the documentary. We're interviewing every weekend, and we're actually doing some really cool interviews with some journalists from the OC Weekly, and we're going to be interviewing the folks that put out Scratch Magazine. So that was a magazine or a fanzine that we all dug on in the 90s when we were getting into the punk scene, or is that our heyday in the 90s?
Yeah, what? I mean, it kind of was,
we
right?
We kind of peaked out like when we were our youth, late 80s, 90s is kind of when we came into it, but just because of our age. But Scratch Magazine, I just remember picking that magazine up every weekend. And
we used to make pilgrimages to Vinyl Solution Record Shop, and outside of it, they had these little racks. And on those racks, they would have Scratch Magazine, OC Weekly, a bunch of other fanzines, and they would have these just multiple stacks of flyers for upcoming shows. So if you wanted to know what was going on, you drop by Vinyl Solution or any record shop in Orange County. I mean, Bionic, they all had the same structure, but you would go to your local record shop, and you would just collect piles of flyers and fanzines, and that's how you knew what was up, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, obviously no internet for us at that time. Still in the Stone Age, but yeah. So that's what's going on right now. I mean, we're just plugging away. We've got some other cool interviews. I don't like to jinx them. Sometimes when I announce them too early, I jinx them and then they get delayed. So I'm not going to jinx them yet. But the ones we have going on soon are the ones I just plugged. That's going down for sure, unless there's an earthquake or something fucked up happens, some natural disaster that prevents us from meeting these guys and interviewing them. So,
but. You know what I thought would be cool too for a moment is just to kind of, we brought them up before, but it bears repeating. One, we have a band that we all admire, we're pretty well, but they're called The Spooky, and they have an album out called Horror Punk that is just kind of blowing up right now. And they're doing a new set of pressings for vinyl, and they're doing really well. Hostage Records, we wanted, again, to sort of give a shout-out to Rick and Paul Hostage. They've been really supportive of us, and we love Hostage Records, and they've got a bunch of new releases out from some bands, and we want to give them a shout-out, hello. And also, we've gotten a ton of support, and we've had her on a couple of times now, although we only have one release with her as a guest, I believe, so far. But Allison Braun Photography, we want to just give a special shout-out to her. She's been really awesome in helping us coordinate some of our interviews, and she's been just a fantastic guest. And we have some really exciting podcasts coming up with her guest hosting.
Yeah. Yep, Allison's been super cool. It's really cool to you see their photographs, and then you finally get to meet these people, like Ed and Allison, and there's a whole bunch of other ones. Kevin, I mean, Jesus. I still haven't talked to Linda, but we need to talk to Linda Aaron now.
Yeah, she's another one of those who has just a ton of iconic photos.
Marla, yeah. She's actually hooking us up with some photos. She's coming out with a book too, Marla. And my punk rock life, I believe is what it's called. But she's really cool too. I mean, she actually sent me a bunch of pictures she took from the 80s that she's letting us use for the documentary. I just haven't sent them to Chris yet, but a shit ton of like high quality early 80s Orange County bands. And she was super cool about hooking us up with those. So,
well, that's we've said this before, but like the idea we had kind of resonated with people. Well, the idea that we had and that Rick and Paul helped us sort of develop, into this game plan we have in this documentary. We've gotten so much positive feedback from people, and not just the feedback like thumbs up, hey man, good for you, but a lot of support with photos, with reaching out for other people for us to talk to, suggestions, just in every conceivable way. People have been jumping in to help us out with the documentary for no other reason than to help us out with the documentary.
Oh yeah, I get people hit me up almost daily, you know. So yeah, so it's Marla Watson's. The book is called My Punk Rock Life. She's doing a pre-sale right now. You can find her at mypunkrocklife.com. Super fucking cool pictures. Really good. Really good.
Yeah, I've seen them. They're pretty amazing, man. And so Chris, how you doing over there, man?
I'm good. I'm just sitting over here listening to you guys.
Yeah,
trying to figure out when to jump in.
That's what you do
the
best.
Chatter, man. So give us some of your input on, you know, Scratch Magazine. I mean, you picked that magazine up, right?
Well, that's how we used to find out about shows. Scratch, Mean Street. Do you remember Mean Street?
I remember Mean Street, yeah.
OC Weekly. And I remember the racks in front of vinyl.
Razor Cake.
And also...
Razor Cake, yeah.
I started talking to those
guys. And Electric Chair. That was like the ultimate place to go and get flyers and mags and zines or whatever.
I forgot all about that place, man. I forgot all about Electric Chair. That was a really big place for people to go and figure stuff out.
If you were like super into... if you wanted to get some creepers... like a checkered shirt, you know, they actually had vinyl there. They had a little, at one point they had a vinyl section.
They used to have a lot of like they actually had some pretty cool bootleg vinyl stuff, and they also had a lot of weird little compilations you couldn't find anywhere else. I remember picking up a couple of comps with some bands on them that I'd never heard of, and then later on down the road, I lost the compilations, the physical copies of them, and could never, ever find them again. I remember the name of them, and I remember doing searches, but just lost in time. But they always had a lot of cool stuff that you could only find, like niche stuff you can only find there.
Yeah, and t-shirts. Like, it was always hard to find cool punk t-shirts, so we went there, and every once in a while you would score. Vinyl still always had the best stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
They still do.
We always gravitated to vinyl. So, I mean, everything's good. We're just marching on. We're doing a ton of cool podcasts. The
Mendiolas.
Yes.
Mendiola's Ballroom in Huntington Park.
For some reason, I just can't wrap my head around that name. But, it's funny. I was talking to Michael Vallejo. He does a weekly Facebook show, and he actually was talking about it last night on his show. I was on there, chatting with him and with everybody else, and he was outside of that show, and he never made it in. So he's one of the punks that never made it in, and he said, yeah, it was fucking nuts.
There were a lot of those kids that got stuck outside, so they didn't get into the show, but they were, like, right there for the beating.
Yeah, prime.
So that sucks for them, man. That's going to be a very fun opening to our flyer series, talking about Mendiola's Ballroom and the subsequent riot and the aftermath. That's something we did, and it will be coming out in a future episode, right?
Yeah, and then after this episode, I mean, I'm just going to jinx it, but we are going to be interviewing Jello Biafra finally. We were supposed to do that already, but a couple of us caught a flu, and so we weren't able to. We had to reschedule, but he's been gracious enough to meet with us, so we're going to be interviewing him soon. So after this current episode, we're going to be interviewing Jello about the PMRC experience, and that's it, man. So I say we get into it. You want to introduce who we're bringing on today?
we're going to be interviewing Christopher Rest tonight. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because this guy was a member of the band RKL and has the distinction of being the only member of RKL from start to finish. He was the only constant member of that band from its inception till the moment they broke up. So he has a lot of history with RKL. And in addition to that, the guy is a guitar player for Lagwagon. We all love that band too. Chris especially loves Lagwagon.
Yeah, RKL, man, I'm so stoked. Just, you know, growing up listening to RKL, I mean, I think I was a freshman, and that was one of the first times, like, they were like, for me, the ultimate punk party band, because it's like, you know, when you heard the name Rich Kids on LSD for the first time, you're like, oh shit, that's a fucking rad name. And then you see their album, a bunch of kids, and you're like, whoa, those guys are like my age, it looks like.
Yeah, we used to see this guy, shout out to Bill King, wherever he may be.
Yeah,
is he still around?
I'm sure
he was
still,
like
I'm
a sure couple years around. Older than us, but he was always skating around downtown Huntington, and he would wear like an RKL shirt, and I was like, dude, that guy's so cool, and he's wearing.
Yeah.
So that's how I was turned on to this band, by these like older punk guys that were like wearing the t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah, I remember Sean. I don't know if you remember Sean's story, but he had an RKL the face melt dude tattooed on his back of his calf,
shit.
And that's when I first. And I think I was hanging out with him as a freshman, and I'm like, what the fuck is that? Then he puts on the album, and I was like, I'm hooked. This shit's the best.
Yeah, back then it was even more of a commitment to get a tattoo of a band on you or any kind of tattoo, you know? I mean, it wasn't like it was totally taboo in the 80s or 90s, but it was still kind of a rarity to see like an RKL tattoo on someone.
Yes, yes. So you know what? I say we get to it. Christopher's waiting for us. So
all right.
Who's going to
I got.
You got a song?
Chris has a song for us, man. Let's do it.
I guess. So I think in the spirit of the guest that we're interviewing, I am going to play Life in a Bottle by RKL.
Life in a Bottle.
I love all those albums.
Fuck yeah. Right, let's check it out, and we'll be back in a moment with Christopher Rest.
Hello, Chris? hey, thanks for taking our call tonight.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Yeah, huge RKL fans here and Lagwagon okay. fans. So, I mean, cool. We all grew up. We're a little younger, so we got into it. I'm thinking, I mean, I was a freshman in high school when I first heard RKL, and but that was probably like late 80s.
Freshman in high school would be 89, 90, 88, somewhere around there.
Yeah. And you guys were just like, I'm like, when I heard the name RKL, I was like, oh shit.
Rich kids on LSD.
That's so rad. And then, like, you know, we're all partying and everything. And then, so you guys are like our favorite punk party band. And then, obviously the Mystic albums were game changers for us as well. So we've been following you forever.
Rad. Thanks.
So as far as your career, can we talk about how you met those guys, how you started playing music in the first place? What brought you into that lifestyle?
Sure. So my dad was a guitar player and a mandolin player. And, you know, I had really young parents. They were kind of hippies when I was born. And I always had guitars around. And he tried to get me into guitar. But, you know, when you're a little kid and you play acoustic guitar and you mostly listen to rock music, it didn't really do it for me. And so I actually started playing piano. My mom taught me some piano, and then I actually took some lessons. And then we had some guy that was renting a room from my parents, and he taught me like some boogie-woogie kind of piano stuff. And so I started to improvise on piano a little bit, and that kind of got me into just kind of like the, oh wow, you can just create your own kind of jams. And then I started playing drums around that same time. So I was playing drums and piano, and then through another person that was renting a room from my mom, he had an electric guitar. And the first time I played electric guitar, I was like, oh, this is what I was looking for. You know, I knew right away that was something I wanted to do.
How old were you when you were doing this?
That was probably almost 13 when I started playing guitar.
Wow. And so was there distortion on that guitar, or is that just like
I think so. He also had an e-bow, which is this electronic bow thing that you put on the strings and it vibrates the strings. It sounds like a bowed instrument, kind of. It's a cool little gadget. It was one of the prototypes, and the e-bow is something that is still around today, and it's still the same exact product that it was then. It was like 1980 probably.
Wow. So you're starting to play electric guitar. When did you start getting into punk? When did that influence you?
Well, so I didn't have any older siblings or anything, and most of my friends were my own age. And again, someone that was renting a room from my parents had a record collection, and they had the Clash London Calling was part of their collection. And that was among the records that I liked out of his collection. I didn't know that that was punk rock. I just liked the cover because the guy's like, you know, about to smash his bass. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
But I was also super into like ELO and Cheap Trick and Led Zeppelin and what else? The Cars was like my favorite band. But I used to play drums to Led Zeppelin records a lot. And then, so as soon as I discovered electric guitar, my mom rented me a guitar and I started taking a few lessons. And I kind of started getting out away from the drums because my dad got sick of it. And at one point he moved me into the basement to play drums, and it was too scary down there, so I pretty much just started playing guitar. Nice. We lived in this big spooky house. When I first moved to Santa Barbara, I was from Orange County actually, and I'm not born there, but I lived in Orange. I kind of grew up in Orange County till I was 9 years old, and we moved to Santa Barbara, to Montecito actually, and they bought this big old dilapidated house in Montecito, and it was like super creepy. And the the basement was even creepier than the house. Wow. And so once I moved my drums down there, that was it. I just switched to guitar. Oh, shit.
So how did you, when did you start meeting up with other people and jamming and kind of doing that thing?
So since I had the drums in my room at certain times, I think I eventually moved them back in. I would have friends come over, I'd play guitar and they'd play drums. And then when I started junior high school, I met these two guys, Sean and Barrett. Sean ended up being the drummer for that band, Rat Pack.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember them?
They're a Mystic. Oh, totally. Yep.
They're a Mystic band. And Barrett was in a band. He sang for a band called the Boxheads later on. But, we were just like the three amigos. We just hung out all the time. We'd go to my house and record things. We'd just put the boom box in one part of the room, and then we'd kind of set the guitar amp nearby, and then the drums were on the other side. And so Barrett would just sing right into the boom box, and we would just jam. And then we had these demo tapes that were pretty funny. They were pretty cool, actually.
That's rad. You know, you're so young and you're just dabbling around. It's so like, it's so unique and so like, what's the word? Just, such a like a it's like a different type of experience, you know, when you're just first getting into it and playing, and it's raw, and it's rad, man.
Yep. Hold on, my dog has a mask. He got a mask off the table. Drop it.
Well, that's responsible. That's a very responsible dog.
Right. Yeah. So eventually, my family split up, and we moved out of the big house, and my mom moved us to a smaller little town nearby called Summerlin. And that's where I met Bomber. So Bomber would always hang out at this house that we were renting there. And he had already played drums a little bit. He learned how to play on a kit that I believe belonged to the drummer for Ugly Kid Joe.
Oh, wow.
But he hadn't been playing long at all, but he was the type of guy that any instrument he picked up, he could just instantly play it. So
were you guys were you guys going to school together? Is that how you met him? Or
I met Bomber before that. It was like the summer before, summer between 7th and 8th grade, I think it was. Nice. And so Bomber would come over and Sean would be playing drums and I'd be playing guitar, and Bomber would go, "Hey, let me check it out, the drums." And like, he was just instantly playing way harder and faster, and Sean got totally bummed. And so that was, we still at that point didn't decide to start a band or anything. And so eventually we left that house and moved a little bit further south to Carpinteria, which is just another 10 minutes south of there. And it turned out that Bomber and his mom moved down there too. And so I ran into him and we started playing together even more. And that was the right before the summer before we started high school. And so we pretty much at that point decided that we were going to form a band. And so we moved again. At that point, my mom was kind of moving a lot. We were having hard times. And but we ended up moving to this little rental house, which became the RKL pad.
Nice.
In Montecito. So we were back in Montecito in this little shack of a rental. And this was the summer right before we started high school. And so we're like, well, my friend Nathan was just this little kid and he didn't know how to play anything, but we showed him how to play a few songs that we wrote, and he was playing bass, and we said, well, we need a second guitar player. And so we actually called Joey Cape, because I knew him from grade school and I knew that he played guitar, and he said, yeah, I'll play guitar if my friend Jason Sears can sing. And I go, oh, I know Jason. Yeah, that guy's crazy. I said, sure, bring him over. And so Jason, it was me and Jason and Bomber and Joey and this little guy, Nathan, on bass. And that was the only rehearsal that Joey came to. I don't think we were, he was like kind of into metal at that time. And we were just playing like Agent Orange covers and Wasted Youth covers and stuff. Like, so, so he wasn't really into us, I don't think.
It's funny because I read some stuff about your you know, your formative years, and what I read was that you guys asked Joey to join as a second guitarist, and he said, "Yeah, I'll do it, but you got to get Jason, my friend Jason Sears, in the band." And then once that happened, all of a sudden Cape was frequently, what I read was frequently unavailable due to being grounded much of the time.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
So okay, so I mean, go on.
I don't remember that part of it, but it's possible. But he only was at one rehearsal, as far as I can remember.
Right. Okay. So you guys were off and running from that point. Did things? Yeah.
So we started playing parties right away. Like within a month, I think we played our first party, and we were called Social Revolt. But I remember some guy we knew was like, "Oh, those guys are just a bunch of rich boys on L or something." And, and so we said, "Well, let's just call it, you know, Rich Kids on LSD." And then like, so me and Jason were, I'm pretty sure we were probably frying on acid. We were talking about that cartoon, Beanie and Cecil, that we used to watch. We go, "Oh, that's so cool. You wore a hat with a propeller on it, you know, that's kind of like a weird taking your head trip kind of thing." And so what if we use that as like our mascot? And Jason drew the first one. And as far as this is how I remember, there's some controversy over who drew the first Beanie Boy, but I believe it was Jason, because we were talking about that cartoon. And and then, you know, Danny Seitz eventually, you know, redrew it into like the Beanie Boy that we all know. And so then, you know, our bass player, he wasn't really into punk rock. He wanted to just be a surf rat, and he eventually quit pretty quickly. And then my uncle actually started playing bass for a little bit. Oh, nice. He's only a couple of years older than me, and he was living with us for about 6 months of that freshman year, I believe. And then he eventually moved back to LA. And so let's see what happened. Then we got, I don't know if you know who Alpo is, Alan Duncan.
Yeah.
But he was a guitar player in Rat Pack. And we asked him to play bass. And then when we finally got Vince on bass, then Alan switched to rhythm guitar.
Nice. And that was
so
it.
So then we played a show at the Cafe de Grand in Hollywood. It was this tiny little dive place to play. And it was in the basement of this little bar, and half a block away from there was Mystic Records. And so Philco from Mystic was at our show, and he said, "Hey, how would you guys like to record some songs, and we'll put you guys on a compilation?" And so that's when we recorded for the Nardcore comp.
Yeah, and those are legendary comps for sure.
Yeah, and I think Alpo played on those recordings, those three songs, and I think he might have played also on the 7-inch. So what they would do is they'd put a bunch of bands on a comp, and whoever got the most fan mail, he'd do like a 7-inch. And then if that did okay, then they'd do a 12-inch. And so that's how we ended up doing Beautiful Feeling and then Keep Laughing with Mystic. And
quick question. When you guys were writing those first songs, how did that writing process go? I hear like Bomber was like, you know,
yeah, he took over songwriting very, very quickly. Like, I wrote the first few songs. There's like, you know, Political Destruction, Not Guilty. Those were songs that I wrote. They're pretty basic thrash songs. And then, you know, Bomber wanted to move more in the direction of Bad Religion and Minor Threat, and his songs sounded more like that. But then we started incorporating more like Bad Brains and like Iron Maiden a little bit. Yeah. And that's kind of where we kind of got so much of our riffy stuff, was kind of combining a lot of classic rock and classic metal with the punk bands that we liked, and which were like, you know, Bad Brains, Suicidal, Battalion of Saints. So, you know, Battalion of Saints was one of my favorite bands because they were kind of like Motorhead on speed, like on more speed or something.
Yeah, Battalion of Saints ruled. So, yeah, so when you guys went into record, you guys were young, right? Like 15 or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. I was 15. And I think, yeah, for sure, 15 when we did the hardcore comp and the 7-inch, and maybe 16 when we did the 12-inch.
How did that feel to go actually into a studio at that age? And you know, you guys are, you know, what was that experience like for you?
It was exciting. I mean, we had already recorded two demos. There used to be a place in Ventura that was $100 for 8 hours, and we did two demos there. There's still some really bad copies of those recordings, or maybe not the whole thing, but there's a couple. One of my friends has been posting on YouTube a couple of those recordings.
Oh, the early ones?
Yeah.
Somebody has it, right? That's cool. So, yeah, I mean, so when those albums came out, I mean, those were the albums, like, you know, the Super 7 samplers and the comps, mm-hmm. you know, all those. That's how we would learn about all these Nardcore bands. Was from those Mystic comps, and then you'd pick up the 7. I wouldn't even know what the band would sound like. I would just buy them because they were on Mystic Records, and at that time, it seems like everything they were putting out, like they put out a lot of good bands, like you guys, Ill Repute, you know, Dr. No, and
They were putting out a lot of bands that, you know, at the time, I don't think anybody else would have signed us, but you know, over the years, I mean, they never paid any of their bands. We never got one single cent from them, even now. But I'm looking back, you know, if they hadn't have put those records out, I don't even know if we would have continued as a band, you know.
Yeah,
because it was hard to get signed by any other labels back then.
Yeah, it's like a double-edged sword. It's like you're not going to make shit, but you're going to get recognition. I know, like, you know, that. I mean, honestly, it's those albums, like, were near and dear to our hearts, you know, listening to those albums when we were kids, you know, 1989, 88, you know, obviously those were out at for a time, but yeah, those were great.
RKL was one of those bands that I did get to see you guys. But I saw you much later on. You guys, I saw you at Iguanas in Tijuana with, Offspring and Rancid when they had their first album. But yeah. I always, you know how there's always those bands where you go, man, if I could have seen them, you know, during this album, during this tour, you know? And RKL was always one of those bands I regretted not being quite old enough to catch in the earlier days, because you guys had a reputation. Great one.
I mean, yeah, we didn't have Bomber at that point, but
no,
think the guitar playing was, and the bass playing was, you know, way more refined by that point, by the time we got to Epitaph, you know.
So I don't want to skip too far ahead. We're still on more of the early days, but I do want to hear a little more about at some point how the transition was to go from Mystic and what you were doing to you guys had a hiatus, and then you had Reactivate, right? Was that your first? And there was some controversy there, and you guys had, you know, you figured some stuff out. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about how what brought on the hiatus, what brought you guys back, and how you guys got yourselves back on track, because you eventually did, and you landed on Epitaph, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a lot that happened before the Reactivate thing, because we did two U.S. tours. One was off the Keep Laughing record, and we toured with Dr. No in one van. It was RKL and Dr. No in one van with all our gear in one vehicle, and we just did this horrible tour.
That's rad, though.
and And so somehow we made it home from that. I think actually Bomber got sick and flew home on that tour. He might have done it on both tours, U.S. tours. I can't remember. Let's see. After that, we went, decided to go up and play San Francisco because we heard there was like nowhere for us to play in Santa Barbara. Every time we played, the cops would show up. And so we just went up to this place that Bomber heard about called the Vats in San Francisco. It was an old Hams brewery, and MDC and DRI lived in,
yeah,
and practiced there. Yeah. And so we drove up there, we pulled up, we met the MDC guys, and we asked if we could practice there, and they let us practice there. We stayed in some weird room. and we met Barry because he was playing with, I think he was still playing with DRI at that point. And so we got a gig. I can't remember what the first show was, but we got to play at Mabuhay Gardens the next day. And we had met Barry. And so then, this is really early on, because you know those Mr. Spock samples that we used on the 7-inch?
Yeah, yeah.
That was from Barry. He brought those down to us. So
This
probably happened, I guess this happened before the Dr. No tour. I can't even remember. There's some foggy, and it's a pretty long time ago.
Totally.
But yeah, we met Barry there, and he also was that crank call on the other side where he said, "Can I describe my penis to you?"
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah, that's Barry.
That's so cool.
You know. So what happened was, let's see. So Santa Barbara was getting pretty stale for us, and
you guys moved to San Francisco, right?
We did. Jason never moved up there. He loved Santa Barbara and Montecito so much. He was like this kind of clique of dudes that were his group of friends called the Cito Rats. And he was like the king of that group of dudes. And so he just was like
living
in yeah, he was in his zone down in Montecito. And moving to San Francisco was a shock for me. I mean, I was like a Spicoli punk rock kid, surfer.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I moved to this freezing big city where I didn't know anybody. And I was, you know, just maybe 16 or 17, I guess.
What? Do you know what year that was?
To drink it.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what year that might have been?
I must have been 86.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we did a tour, another U.S. tour, the Disaster 86. And we toured with that Canadian band Beyond Possession.
Oh wow! Yeah, and that was for Keep Laughing. Was that for the Keep Laughing LP?
Yeah, they actually sent us a box of records on that tour. They showed up in New York or something, and we got like maybe 50 records or something. And that was all we ever got from Mystic.
50 records,
box of records.
Oh shit!
Wow. So you guys figured on pretty early on that Mystic was not going to be able to keep up with maybe the demand that you guys were, because you were building quite a buzz at that time already, right?
It didn't seem like it yet.
No. I mean,
we were still playing these horrible little clubs like with thrash bands that were horrible, and the promoters were like 17-year-old kids, and both of those tours were disasters completely.
You guys were on some pretty good bills, though. I mean, what were some of your favorite, like, early on shows that you did play? I mean, you guys played with the Ramones. You guys played...
That show was a disaster, kind of. I'd say, like, Poison Idea. We played with Poison Idea and the Satyricon, I think. That was a cool one. And some of these shows, I see the flyers, and I'm like, I don't even know if we showed up at that show.
The flyers
are cool.
I don't
remember playing with them.
So from one point, you do that tour. At one point, you guys go from Mystic, and at some point, you put out Rock and Roll Nightmare, I think around, what, 87 on Alchemy? Was it on Alchemy Records?
Yeah, somehow Bomber met this guy. who, what was his name? I usually can remember his name, but right now it's drawing a blank. But it was just a two-man record label, and they were based out in London pretty much. There's this guy, Mark, and then Victor was the other guy. And somehow Balmer, I don't know where he met him or what, but somehow he convinced him to put out a record with the full comic book, the lyric sheet, which must have cost a fortune. And it all came together. Balmer, like, just basically forced Danny to, he wouldn't let him leave the house until he finished drawing these drawings. And so
that all came together.
But the Rock and Roll Nightmare album was written when Balmer, I think it was the Beyond Possession tour, Balmer got hepatitis when we got to the East Coast, and he flew home from there. And so we had to drive all the way home with no shows. So that must be the tour that fell apart. And we had this promoter in New York named Johnny Stiff, and he booked our whole tour, and he was like looking forward to us playing the show in New York. And we're like, where's Balmer? And he's like, oh, he flew home sick. And he said, you tell Balmer I'm gonna go out to California and fuck up his whole family.
God damn.
The mafia, man.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. No, he said, I'll kick his whole family's ass.
Did he have that New York accent going?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Sopranos.
Johnny Stiff. And,
so would he come off?
So during that time when Balmer had hepatitis, he was just stuck at home, and he had one of my guitars and some 4-track recorder, and he wrote that whole album within a month.
Shit. Oh yeah. And then Vince left the band around then, right? So
he wasn't into all this super technical stuff that we were starting to play. And like, he would even like dumb down some of the early stuff that was on Keep Laughing. You know, he wanted everything to be very straightforward. He didn't think it was punk rock to do, you know, guitar or gymnastics or whatever. So
yeah,
we were kind of going different directions. And so we didn't have a bass player. For a while we had this guy, Ricky, on bass, and he was learning the songs with us and stuff, but he was just too much of a, too lazy basically. And never had any money, didn't have a place to live. Always, you know, we called him, his name was Ricky Bowersock, but we called him Rickety Borrow a Sock, because he'd always be like, can I borrow a sock?
Borrow a sock, just one.
There's video of him playing a pretty rad show that we played at the farm in San Francisco. And we go, watch, he's not going to have a pick. So we said, okay. So we found this super thin pick. It was like paper thin, like some weird jazz pick. Well, we'll give him this pick when he asked for the pick. And so, like, sure enough, he's like, hey, can I borrow a pick? And we're like, yeah, here you go. And then it was like, okay, you guys are on. And he's like, so you can see he was super bummed.
It's like paper.
Hey, you know, speaking of, I want to ask you a question about the technical aspects of the band at that time. You mentioned that you were moving forward, you guys were evolving and being a little more complex in your musical arrangements and how you were playing. Was this something that was like, did you guys come to a decision to do this, or was it more of a natural evolution of the band?
Just Balmer. I mean, Balmer was just, he had all these things in his head, and we had to try to, I mean, he would show us these songs, we're like trying to learn these insane riffs that, like, it just seemed impossible. And so we rehearsed, like, the funny thing is that Rock and Roll Nightmare, we didn't have a bass player, we didn't have a rehearsal space. We practiced a few times with just guitars and drums before we recorded, but most of the rehearsals that we did were just on the couch in Barry's apartment.
Oh, wow.
So we had never played with a bass player these songs, really. And so we went back down to Santa Barbara to record. We recorded drums with scratch guitars, and then Bomber went back and played bass, and then we did the real guitar tracks over that.
Man, so, I mean, yeah, Rock and Roll Nightmare is really technical, so, I mean, it sounds like it was intimidating. Were you, I mean, it was hard for you to pick those songs up, or
did you? We worked on them pretty hard. You know, me and Barry and Bomber worked together for a couple of months before we went to record. And just every day we were just sitting on the couch going over these songs.
Did Jason write the lyrics for that, or did Bomber just take over the
whole? Bomber wrote a lot of them, but Jason helped for sure.
Nice.
So you guys toured for that record as well, right?
Let's see. Well, yeah, because the Beyond Possession tour had to be. Yeah, this is where my timeline gets kind of confused.
It's all right, but that album came out in 87, so somewhere between 87 and 89, when you guys released the Double Live in Berlin LP,
our first time to Europe was 88, and Barry had met Dave Pollock from Destiny Tour Booking when he went to Europe. He shaved his hair into a bozo haircut, and he was like a bozo punk. Nice. And he's like went and stayed in squats, and he was in Berlin and Hamburg, and just checking out the punk scene all around Europe, and taking trains and doing whatever Barry did. And he met Dave Pollock and gave him a copy of our record on tape, I believe. And so then Dave said, "Hey, you guys should come out here and tour," and we did the 88 tour, and it was way better than anything we had ever played in the States, besides maybe the farm shows. Those were some good shows that we played in San Francisco, but besides that, mostly we were unknown California band. We never got any recognition in fanzines or anything. They always talked about Nardcore, but they always skipped over RKL because we're from Santa Barbara. I don't know, man.
You guys are always popping up in my head.
Yeah, we definitely associated you with Nardcore.
Yeah, you guys are like my favorite, and we're from Orange County, Huntington Beach.
At the time, it seemed like we were not getting any recognition or any shows. You know?
Well, it could be a hindsight of 2020 type of thing. People come to realize later on when you go back over the history that you guys were an integral part of it. You know, that might be how it went down. But so that happens. You guys end up releasing Double Live in Berlin in 89 around then. And then you have a bit of a gap. You have a gap from 89 because you had Revenge is a Beautiful Feeling.
We did two European tours in a row. 88 and 89.
Okay.
And then we got home and we played the Reseda Country Club. And that was like sold out show. I heard it sold out in 20 minutes or something. And we had never sold out anything in California before. So like something had happened during those 2 years where we went to Europe. And then we did the Ramones show. And I think that might have been our last show with Bomber on drums. And Bomber was so sick of buying cymbals and hauling drums around, and he had all this music in his head, and he actually thought, you know, he heard these songs in his head with full harmonies, and you know, he grew up listening to all the classic rock bands before he got into punk, and so he was into, you know, Queen and all this big rock music, and that was the kind of stuff he was hearing in his head. And in his mind, Jason was holding us back with his gravel vocals. He wasn't really a musician, in according to Bomber. And so Bomber wanted to sing, and so he said, "I'm sick of playing drums. I'm gonna start another band, and I'm gonna be the singer." And he found some other guitar player and a couple of friends to play drums and bass, and that band never ended up playing any shows. But once the guitar player kind of left, I wasn't doing anything because there was no more RKL, and so I joined his band, which eventually became Slang, which was kind of
Slang. Yes, I saw funky, Slang.
Yeah, So yeah, so Slang is the band that got signed to Epitaph. And at the very last minute, Balmer and Brett Gurwitz decided to call the band RKL. And because somehow Brett was convinced that Balmer was RKL. And in a lot of ways he was, but without Jason, obviously it was not
RKL. Yeah. I saw you guys at the Anaconda, and Slang, members of RKL. I was like, yeah, RKL. And I think Jason came out and sang one song at the end.
Yeah, he did, and went nuts or something.
Yeah, he went fucking berserk. And then we were actually able to party with those guys. And I don't know if you were there, but Jason was at this party afterwards, and we're like, oh fuck, there's Jason. And we're like young and we're stoked. And I remember that Slang show. I think Scared Straight played, I think, as well.
Yeah, so we had a different guitar player at that point. We were just it was a dark time for us, because like we had this other drummer in Slang who was like a progressive, you know, he was a sort of a Rush type drummer. He wasn't into punk rock at all, and then but we were very funky, you know, Slang, and Little Joe was playing all kinds of funky bass stuff. And you know, Balmer wanted to be kind of like Living Color or something. So he thought we were going to be mainstream, you know. The way he heard his music in his head was like big mainstream rock. He thought punk rock was done basically. And he thought he had outgrown punk rock. But then, so we went to Europe after this Reactivate record came out, and we opened for NoFX, and NoFX had just blown up. Like they took over where we failed, and just, it was huge. And we were just blown away. Like we pretty much got blown off the stage. And so we were touring as RKL with Balmer on vocals. We did about half of this European tour, and our good friend that was with us, he was our roadie. He died while we were in Zurich. He went out on his birthday, and the next morning he wasn't there when we went to time to leave. And it turned out that he had OD'd in the park, in Junkie Park in Zurich. So that was pretty devastating for all of us. He was a really close friend. And,
oh, man.
And then so Balmer said, I can't handle this. And he flew home. And we were like, well, what should we do? And we said, we'll just call Jason and, you know, and have Jason come out, and we'll finish the tour with him. But at that time, Jason was all strung out on drugs. So he had to come over, and he was totally, you know, having withdrawals. We did one show in Barcelona, and then we went out to Mallorca Island so he could detox, essentially. And we ended up actually playing a show with some in Mallorca, but with borrowed equipment. And besides the Ramones, we were the only American punk band ever to play in Mallorca.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So how was Jason? I mean, yeah. So I guess he was having issues with substance abuse. When you guys were touring around as RKL, I mean, that must've been hard for him.
Yeah, it was horrible. Like, so this tour actually though, like after he detoxed, he was like great. He was back to being super funny, just regular Jason. And so, you know, that was the tour where we recorded that Testicle G and the Feel My Nut Posse when we got back to Berlin. And that, it was really fun. Like there was a lot of really fun to that second half of the tour where Jason was singing was like some of my greatest memories of RKL.
Oh, that's rad.
Because all of a sudden we didn't have this, you know, everyone hated this Reactivate version of the band, and then we had Jason back, and then, you know, Balmer was always complaining about stuff and yelling, and so without him, you know, kind of being a thorn in everybody's side, we just had this group of friends that were getting along really well. I mean, but you know, but then we get home, we're like, shit, we don't have Balmer to songwrite anymore. So we had to write an RKL record that we thought was on par with Rock and Roll Nightmare, and that's where we wrote the Riches to Rags record.
Well, also during that time, Epitaph re-released Rock and Roll Nightmare, right? So you guys are sort of getting back on track with the fans. And
yeah, they got the license for it through Bomber somehow. And somehow I was written out of the contract.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, well, because Bomber was pissed that we...
Oh, okay.
He was pissed that we formed RKL without him. He thought that when he quit, that would be the end of RKL. But so now he had formed The Other with Boz and Rich Marin on guitar, and they were actually recording an album for Epitaph, and we they opened for NOFX in San Francisco. They played that that Epitaph show in Hollywood, the Summer Nationals. They played the day before we did. It was like a 2-day kind of almost festival show at the Palladium, I think.
Yeah, I remember that.
What was Bomber's band? Was he wasn't
The RKL. Other.
Slang was that other band that he was in.
Yeah, it was The Other. It was Bomber played bass and sang, and then Boz played drums and Rich played guitar.
Oh, okay.
So can you describe a little bit, because now you're without Bomber, who was like the main songwriter and arranger. You guys come in to the studio to do Riches to Rags. What was that like? And what was your lineup at that time? And, you know,
it was Dave on drums, me and Barry on guitar, and Little Joe on bass, and Jason on vocals.
Was it difficult, or was it, a bit of a relief to kind of let go of all that tension from, the previous tours and recording process?
Writing the record was difficult because we knew we had a lot to live up to. And since Bomber had written the majority of our contemporary stuff, we knew we had to step it up and really make it rad. And so we like demoed all the stuff. We were pretty well prepared when we went in. And we did the record in a reasonable amount of time. I remember we did have to get a little extra money from Epitaph to finish the recording. And like Brett was like, Rancid just recorded their record in 3 days. I was like, yeah, Rancid's songs are different than our songs. I was like, our songs were gnarly. Like, I'll take it for granted. The bass playing in Rancid is kind of technical, but most of their songs are pretty basic, pretty punk band.
Yeah. I mean, comparatively speaking, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of like the guy who produced this record, the Riches to Rags record, had just done a thrash metal band called Forbidden, and he was like a metal producer. So it was like kind of perfect because he was into this fast technical stuff, and he could see what we were doing. And so he got it, and the record came out pretty awesome. And
it was the first time that I finally got to see you guys, like I said before. And you guys were very tight. You killed it. It seemed like you guys were very comfortable on stage with each other. And from a fan standpoint, I mean, it seemed like you guys had it all together at that point. Did it feel that way to you?
There were definitely some times where we were on it. Yeah. We did quite a bit of touring with that lineup. US tour, went to Japan, couple European tours. The second European tour, I don't think Jason had enough time to get off drugs. And so at that point, his girlfriend was also strung out, and so he brought her on the tour and their kids. So they had a little daughter and a son, and then so they were strung out. It was horrible. And so at the end of that tour, Jason said, I quit, because there was a lot of tension. Yeah. He kept having to take merch money to go score, and we were just, everyone was getting sick of the whole thing. So
after that happened, and eventually you guys, disbanded permanently, I wanted to, we've spent so much time on RKL because we just love the band, but we also love a lot of the stuff that you've done after that. And so can we talk about where you went from there when RKL disbanded? Well, you can talk about, you know, how that finally happened, but I want to talk a little more about what you've done after, because you've done so much cool stuff and we're all fans of the, you know, you spent some time in, did you spend some time in No Use for a Name? Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then of course, eventually you landed in Lagwagon. So can we talk a little bit about what happens after, you know, RKL?
Yeah. So we'll, RKL, we were still trying to write songs and we were demoing songs and we kept, you know, sending them the songs down to Jason in Santa Barbara, and he, we never heard from him basically. And then all of a sudden Dave got a phone call and Lagwagon wanted him to start playing drums when Derek left. And so he was gone all of a sudden. So we didn't even have a drummer. And that was at that point, that was when I joined the other, and with, because Rich had just quit Bomber's band. And so I joined the other, and we recorded that album for Honest Dawns, which was a branch of Fat Records.
I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. So that record is actually one of my favorite things that I ever played on. We were so well rehearsed for that record. Like me and the drummer practiced at least like 4 times a week. I mean, we practiced a lot and we were so well prepared. We recorded with Ryan Green. We went in there and set up in this little room, like all together, and just went through the whole set and then just recorded it like super quick. It was just, it all came together really fast.
Yeah, I have a question regarding, so you mentioned earlier that you had, Bomber was upset that you guys went on to play without RKL, without him, and kind of written you out of the contract for the Epitaph re-release of Rock and Roll Nightmare. Did, for you to go back and start jamming with him, did you, was there, it sounds like there wasn't any animosity with you guys.
I actually didn't know at that point that I was not on the contract. But yeah, I mean, I didn't see anyone getting rich off of that record.
Yeah, totally. Okay.
So Lagwagon actually called me at one point and said, "Hey, do you want to play guitar? We're about to record this record." And I said, "Sure." And I started, you know, learning their older records. And then all of a sudden they said, we got this guy, Ken Stringfellow from the Posies, to play guitar. Sorry. And so they recorded the double platinum record and then they went to Europe. And Ken got in like a bar fight and blinded some guy at the, near the end of their tour. And so they kicked him out of the band and called me and said, "Hey, we're on our way back to the States to start Warped Tour." This is 97 Warped Tour. And they said, "Do you want to meet us in Chicago and do the Warped Tour?" And I said, "Well, okay, but I don't really remember any of the stuff." And so I had to like cram. And then I showed up in Chicago. We had one day to rehearse. We got this studio and the power went out on the whole block during the rehearsal within like 20 minutes. Oh, shit. So we're practicing in the dark with no amps. And then the next day was my first show with Lagwagon on the main stage at the Warped Tour in a thunderstorm.
No pressure.
Yeah, I'm sure it was pretty rough.
Man, that's crazy. That's a hell of a way to start, man. And that's a hell of a way to land the gig. I mean, that's insane.
That's a roller coaster, emotional roller coaster ride right there. Yeah.
So how did it feel? So you've been playing with other people here and there, and you've had, you know, it wasn't like you jumped from RKL right to Lagwagon, but how did it feel? Did you guys click musically pretty quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I already knew Joey, like, obviously, and
right.
And Dave was, I'd already jammed with Dave a lot. And Jesse was, you know, super talented, and I knew Flip from Santa Barbara. So we were all from the same area, and it just kind of worked. Like later when I did Mad Caddies and No Use for a Name was during that time when Joey thought, he kind of thought Lagwagon was holding him back, and he wanted to do, you know, Bad Astronaut, and he did Bad Loud, and what else? He did like four or five projects in the early 2000s that, you know, I think Bad Astronaut is the most well known. But during that time, we weren't touring or anything. And so that's when I, you know, No Use called me and asked me if I wanted to be in that band. And it wasn't long after that I started playing with No Use that all of a sudden Lagwagon started booking shows again. So there was a time when I was playing in both bands. We even did a tour where I was playing with both bands in Europe. So I had to do two sets a night. And then we did some other tour in on the West Coast where I was playing one night Lagwagon, one night No Use for a Name. So it was like a fat tour thing.
Oh, man, wow. That is a lot to have to absorb and keep straight, man. I don't know how you do that, dude. I don't want to sidetrack too much, but I mean, we're also fans of, you know, No Use for a Name as well. So what was it like playing with Tony and those guys, man?
It was awesome. We had already done quite a bit of touring with No Use, so I knew all those guys really well. And I always thought Tony's songs were brilliant, and I was really looking forward to recording a record with them, and unfortunately that never happened.
Right, and that's very unfortunate for all of us, you know. So, yeah, well, but so you,
I think some of these bands were, I mean, at that time, late '90s. I mean, you know, NoFX, and I mean, you guys were pretty big. I mean, were you living off your music at that point?
Well, let's see. there were times when I was making a lot of money from Lagwagon. I did a couple tours with No Use and made some good money. But, you know, I was also, during the downtimes, I was actually working as a caregiver for this elderly woman that I got through my mom. So that was like total different.
Yeah,
spectrum, yeah. And playing punk shows to be, you know, caregiver.
Empathy right there for sure, man. Yeah, so yeah, I guess you always have to have a side gig going on, you know. Yeah. It's hard to maintain.
You've been pretty steady on with Lagwagon though ever since, and
I have a day job now, and I also teach guitar in the evenings. I mean, I build circuit boards and stuff for my wife's parents' electronics company.
Oh, cool.
And they just build stuff for other companies.
You started doing the guitar lessons. I don't know when you started, to be honest, but I noticed it right around the pandemic, around 2020. You were doing a lot of remote stuff, right?
That's when I started it, because I couldn't go to my day job because I was quarantined after coming back from Australia. And so I just posted a video that I was giving lessons, and I got a few students right away.
Oh, I've no doubt.
And I just that's been steady pretty much ever since.
So can I ask you just a little bit about do you notice a certain I don't mean level of student, but does the range of age vary drastically? Do you have a lot of some guys like our age are like, holy shit, you know, this guy's doing lessons?
For the most part, yeah, there are Lagwagon fans for the most part.
That's awesome.
And RKL fans. But, you know, I have a couple very young students, and they maybe are starting to listen to our bands, but they don't, you know, they listen to all kinds of stuff that, you know, like Green Day or something, but also stuff I never heard of, you know.
That's awesome, man. So it must be really fun for you to get these new kids, you know, into that scene, right?
It's definitely, it's actually more intimidating to me to teach kids than it is to teach people my own age. Because the people at my own age, they just want to learn songs that I already know. Like the kids, they don't know what they want to learn. But
that's funny. Yeah, my 14-year-old son just started picking up guitar, and I was like, when I saw that, I'm like, fuck, I should hire you, man. Give him some lessons, dude. He's got an acoustic, and Bob the Bastard here actually helped me hooked him up with one of his guitars, and it's cool to watch him. He's into it.
It's just cool to see kids that are still into doing that, because with everything being so automated and digital, and with all the things that you could do out there, to sit down and put some work into something like that, I love to see kids or anyone dedicating themselves to it. Right?
People shredding now. These kids are shredding.
Yeah, people say that rock and roll, they've always said it all since I was a little fucking kid. I've heard all rock and roll is dead or it's dying. Or this is that. It's all bullshit. There's always going to be a new wave. And people that respect what you've done, the work that you've laid down. Hey, I wanted to bring this up before I forget. And we're getting to, this has been a long interview and we really appreciate your time. But man, you guys had some shit going down at one of your recent shows, and I wanted to hear a little bit about it right from you. You guys had some gear stolen. What the hell? What in the hell happened on that one? You had a trailer parked, and what happened there?
Yeah, we had a box truck, a rental truck, and they normally we back it up against the wall when we stay at a hotel, but I guess there wasn't one of those spots available. So they just said, one night it'll be fine, but it wasn't fine. And someone basically just, they didn't even cut the lock. They cut the weird arm that latches the door, and they took almost everything out of there. We got a lot of stuff.
And I know that's painful, but the reason I bring it up is not just because I want to talk about how you got your shit stolen. What I was impressed by, man, is that you guys played the gig. You got whatever you had to get, and you guys went out there and you played the gig, and I thought that was so fucking cool. So can you tell me what you guys did to scramble at the last second and get your shit together and make that happen? What did you guys do?
Well, there's other bands there, and but I didn't lose anything personally. My amp head was in my trunk of my car. My guitar was in my hotel room. And the one of the things that they didn't take out of the truck was my speaker cabinet. So somehow, I got through squeaky clean on that one. But
well, kudos for you guys for making that show happen, because a lot of bands would have probably bowed out. So
no way. I mean, we had a guarantee, so we had to.
You had to march on for sure. One thing I just wanted to ask you. I mean, I know it's a hard subject and everything, but I mean, you lost two of your close bandmates, Bomber and Jason, and that must have been devastating for you.
Yeah, and Derek, I have a list of about 40 friends that are gone now. It's crazy.
I know it's such a cliche thing to say, man, but it really is great that you guys were able to lay down all the great music you did. And you guys paved the way for a lot of bands that emulated RKL sound. There's a lot of newer bands that have taken, new fans sound, as well as Lagwagon. So, I mean, you must be very proud of your musical legacy and the relationships you had over the years. When you look back, I know it's sad to lose members, but it must be great to have that legacy to look at.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, there's a lot of things I wish I had done differently, but for sure. I mean, I'm proud of a lot of the stuff I've done. I mean, and all of a sudden, RKL is kind of getting a lot of attention all of a sudden this last 5 years, just kind of had a resurgence for some reason. That's why we decided to put out that Live in the Dive recording,
which just came out just recently, within a month or two ago. And holy shit, you obviously knew how it was going to sound, but man, Stan is such a big fan. I don't want to speak for you, but holy shit, did that record sound great. That Live in a Dive sounds amazing. It might be the best I've ever heard you guys sound.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah, we had, Barry had these tapes just in a box for years and years and years. And, I had no idea that we still had these tapes with all the tracks still separated. The drums were challenging. They didn't get a very good recording of the kick drum and the snare, but the guitars were separated. We were able to pan them left and right, which is the way we always mix guitars. And, you know, every time I had heard that recording, it was that recording was used on our DVD, that Steel Flailing DVD.
Yeah, Steel Flailing after all these beers, right.
Yeah, it was in mono. I didn't realize we had, like, the potential to make it a stereo record. And so
that's rad.
So our friend Justin got a hold of the tapes, and I just told him what I wanted from it, and he did a really good job. He mastered it as well. And then we got Danny to do the artwork, which I think came out really good.
Oh yeah, the album cover looks fucking awesome. It's so cool. It's great, man.
Yeah, so, and that recording is just 1 year later than the Berlin record. It was the next tour.
Yep, totally. So, yeah, man, just, you know, what's Lagwagon? I mean, every time I follow you guys, and I always see these, like, European tours that you guys are on. I mean, how is it in Europe right now, after post-pandemic? Is it going nuts out there?
Yeah, no one's wearing masks. Yeah. It's like, exactly, it's just exactly how I remembered it. Everything was the same.
Yeah. People are just pumped, I guess, you know, now. Yeah. We've been to a few shows, you know, post-pandemic, and the scene seems to be alive, you know, even locally. Even the smaller, like, venues that we go to all the time in our local area seem to just have a lot of cool touring bands, and it's cool to see that people are back at it, you know. The hunger for live music is there for sure.
Yeah, I mean, our last U.S. tour, we had to cancel two different sections of the tour because of people testing positive on our team. And then on this last European tour, Joey's voice totally blew out. And we had the end of the tour was six shows in a row in U.K., and we had to make the call that day. And at that point, Joey couldn't even talk.
Oh, wow.
And so we said, we got to cancel, because if he hurts his voice permanently, we have two more tours in the next 2 months that, you know, we probably won't be able to do. We'd have to cancel those whole tours. So we ended up canceling the UK ending of the tour, and all those, we got a lot of blowback from that, because then they see us announcing all these, you know, this month and next month we're going on these big long tours, and we played one show in Montreal since then, and all these people in UK are like, oh, I guess Joey had an amazing recovery, maybe, or I don't know what they thought.
Well, it's got to be difficult. I mean,
you can't control that. You know what I mean?
And also, you know, Joey had to take some serious medication, and he needed that week off.
Yeah.
Well, also, I would imagine that when you lose a couple of dates due to illness, you guys are booking your stuff way in advance. So you have other shows that you still have to go and make. And then you have to, after that's all, that cycle is done, then you kind of wrap around and make up those dates you lost.
Yeah, people don't realize that these shows have been booked for over a year. They're like, oh, so you just decided to book another tour, huh? It's like, no, this is booked for a year now. But
so before we wrap it up, can you tell us what you guys have on the horizon?
We're leaving on the 25th of this month back to Europe, and then we are doing a U.S. tour in the fall. And then next year, penciled in is some maybe Japan and Australia.
Wow.
Any new material coming out?
Right now, we haven't been working on anything yet.
Well, you have quite a backlog to draw from, so you guys are fine on tour.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome, man.
I'm sure touring nowadays is probably a lot different back when our 89, 88 with RKL. that's awesome, man. You guys are, I mean, it's got to be fun. I mean, it's work, obviously, but, you know, just being able to see the world the way you guys see it, that's got to be a great experience.
Yeah, it is.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, you know what? We really, really appreciate you taking the time. You know, like I said, we're big fans of the music that you've played, and it's really, it's a big treat for us just to sit and listen to your, to the story, and just, you know, the, you know, you went pretty deep with the R. Kale stuff, which was awesome, man. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Oh yeah, we really appreciate it, and good luck on all your upcoming dates. I hope you guys have no drama whatsoever.
Yeah.
And cool, man. And when you guys put something out next, maybe we can hit you up and hear about that again. So
sure.
Yeah, you know what? And I don't want to put you on the spot. So the way we do these shows, our podcast, we have three segments. And so we do our second the second segment, we interview our guest, and then we play a song. And not to put you on the spot, but do you have a song you want to play that we can go into, you know, close the segment out with?
Lagwagon or
whatever you want.
Anything. It doesn't have to be your band. It could be anything. We just choose songs that we're into at the moment. So if you have something you'd like us to play that you love, doesn't matter what it is, we don't care. We'll play it.
Oh, man.
Ah, see, that's what he meant by put you on the spot, man. Sorry. We do this to everybody, man.
How about
me.
Your favorite Mystic Arc Hill song?
Or just whatever you're into. It don't matter.
Let's see. All right, play some Testicle G.
Okay.
Okay, awesome.
Testicle G and the Feel My Nut Posse.
Nice.
Done. We got it. We will have that on, man. So thank you again for being on, and thanks for choosing a song, and I hope you have a great evening, man.
All right, you too. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care. Right,
take care.
Hey, yo, Bugweed, break it down, motherfucker. I said break it motherfucking down, G.
Feel my nut.
Yo, Micro Tyson packed a punch. Moldy P.
I see him down, get drunk. See him when he smokes gum. Kick it back at the crib, I got a bitch in my trunk. She's working real hard, blowing bugging me. She's cold, getting trained by the feeling of posse. Singing faster, faster. I'm a disaster. You by the beer and a steel drink of faster. And a lick of bitch disaster for 6 or 2. I'm throwing a bug and then I spark of the boom. And I'll be crapping to break, get my boring and down. Wanna take a little rest and only be out of fun. Cause I can derby so mean, I'm a little more than green. I give the baby all that I'm out so mean. Feel it, feel it. Call my nut, bitch. Greatest of ease, and if you need some more aluminum, I know you how you please. And then I say, scamble down, lose my cutters, I did. But I laid it on depth, so I can put up the lid. Just a bit of Don Juan, booty licking romancer. Grind across the plank like a fresh scamble dancer. Oh, he throws this, I'm checking all my nuts down. Just kicking with crews, I'm giving up to jump low. Jump back, kick flip, I was checking out the party. Rebel Commando, man, I'm in a dark and cold lamp. I'm getting laid, not one, bitch, two. Licking all the rings, and I'm feeling a crew. Fucking nut, bitch. Feel it, feel it. Hey, yo, Marky Mark, suck on this. You got a little six pack, I got a party ball, G. Don't feel my nut, but it's my chicken a chunk. And I'm hoping to get paid, cause I'm motherfucking proud to see the rats. A little FMN, I throw on the tape, I'm getting laid again. But the bitch is looking dank, staying hard, it ain't easy. Once you lick my ass, trying to please me. I fuck her mama, her daddy's sister too. She's cold, getting fucked by this Jesus crew. My night girl.
Feel it, feel it. Feel it,
feel it. So lick it too. FM and Testicle G and the film on a posse in the house. Hey, yo, Bugweed, let's hit the motherfucking ball and cut this crap out, G. Motherfucker Testicle G and the film on a crew in the house.
All right, that was Testicle G and the Feel My Nut Posse.
That shit was rad, dude.
Of all the shit he was going to pick.
So was that like an RKL side project?
Looks like it. Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, you know, I know Ill Repute did a rap little rap album, or I don't know what they did, but they
I was unaware of that. They did a fucking rap. Which members did that at?
It was John Faniff and Tony Cortez. And fuck, I wish I can't fucking forget the name of it, but yeah, there.
That's crazy. I had no idea. So, and I know, like, of all the things I thought that that Chris was going to pick as far as music, that was the last thing I would have expected. That was awesome. So, yeah. That's cool.
That was a rad segment, and he went deep with the RKL stuff, and fucking, I was stoked to hear that, man. Just listening to his recollection of how they got together, little, you know, they're young bucks, you know, 13, 14 years old, and just how they evolved, man. And like, look where he's at today. You know, he's doing this shit for a living. So it's awesome.
Some bands are just, they are so much more important to the evolution of the genre than people realize. Just because, you know, if you look out there, you go outside of a show and you pull all these kids, they're going to, and ask what their influences are. They're going to run the gambit with all the usual bands. But, you know, it's bands like RKL that really set the tone for other bands to come along. You know, the NoFX's, just whatever. Name any band at all that borrow that from that sound, man. RKL were a benchmark for that, for punk rock in that genre, skate rock.
Yeah.
Party rock.
Unfortunately, my mic was out through that whole thing, so I didn't get to participate in the interview, but here I am. Yeah. I'm still here.
You got to live it, though.
Well, yeah, and we never forgot you. We kept looking at you like we wanted you to jump in there.
What are you jumping in? I didn't know you had an issue there, so that sucks. But it didn't sound like we had to ask him too many questions. He knew the history pretty well, so it was good.
Just because you didn't hear Chris during that segment, trust me, he was involved. We were back and forth. He was keeping us moving. The thing that Chris does best is keep the podcast flowing and keep us moving forward so that we don't get stale and get stuck on one subject for an hour and a half. So thanks to Chris, we got through this thing, and we did it really, really well. We had a fun time.
Totally. So
I'm ready. Are we ready to wrap this thing?
Yeah, it's time to wrap.
Let's wrap it out. So, yeah, I want to take us out. This is one of my favorite RKL songs, and it's called Why.
Why? All right. Why? Enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in once again. We'll be back really soon. Have a great evening.
They seem to be in a state identical to that curious 20th century earth disease called hard drug abuse. As a Vulcan, I find the need for hard drugs to be totally illogical.